Ariel always was one to save things, and this time she surprised me with a whole large envelope of papers and old letters. In 1961, the Mount Pulaski Times News put out a centennial edition, and it seemed to have covered all activity from the time Abe Lincoln was there to the present, even pictures. They even had a picture I had always wished for, the picture of the Wright brothers and their plane when it lit in Obermiller's pasture. This was in 1910. It's a better than usual newspaper picture, and I don't know whether it can be copied or not. There is quite a crowd there, and I was in it, but I can't find me. Then, among other articles, is one entitled Photographic and Photographers Important in Mount Pulaski's Early History. The article was written by Ruth von Lobrecht Bender, and Gerard suggests I use the whole article as is. Alfred, some of the dope I put on tape about photography must have gotten a bit dry, and likely some of this will also, but here goes. Daguerre discovered the method of making photographs in 1839, so all pictures up to this time were drawings and paintings made by artists, and a lot of the time by itinerant craftsmen traveling around the country. It was quite a bit later till the new art was perfected commercially, so it was several years before people were able to have these new kind of pictures of their families. These were better likenesses than the usual run of drawings and paintings are apt to be. One day I asked Mother Bender how come she had baby pictures of some of her children and none at all of the boys. She then told about the traveling photographers who had wagons outfitted as tiny studios. These artists, as they liked to think of themselves, wandered around the country and came to town every few years, and it so happened there were none when some of the children were babies. About 1880, galleries were opened up in towns, and the photographers could stay in one place, so the wagons began to disappear. History is now repeating itself, for we're repeatedly being canvassed regularly by photographers who come to town making pictures. First photographer. The first photographer that I know of was a Mr. Alexander. I know little about him. He died about 1911, and we know he photographed Abe Lincoln before he was president. For then, his old equipment was found there in a showcase, and the Lincoln picture was in it. Frank Snyder broke open the case to get it, and his heirs have the picture. The old case would be priceless if intact. There were old cameras and darkroom articles and the little cases the pictures were put into. He made the earliest types of photos, daguerreotypes and ambrotypes. The tintypes were the last to be developed, and he seemed to have had few of them in his samples. How long he followed the trade, I don't know. My father did not know Mr. Alexander very well, and was unaware he had ever been a photographer. Here I add my little bit. A great deal of this stuff fell into my hands. This door talking. I didn't know what to do with it, and Dad directed me to send it to Don Biedler. I retained only a few choice cases. Don Biedler was a protege of Dad's and got his earliest training under Dad while a schoolboy in Mount Pulaski. Don placed this equipment in the Field Museum in Chicago. The first photographer to live in town and have a gallery, as they were called in those days, was Marcel A. Debose. He was from France and had served in the Civil War. He had a nice little gallery and had many pictures of the folks in the Mount Pulaski vicinity. He had seven children, Flora, Carl, Jean, Josie, Rodman, Victor and Louise. Louise was in my high school graduating class, door talking again. He died about 1910, and Carl was the only one of the children to follow his father's trade. In the late 80s or early 90s, there was another photographer in town. He was an itinerant who decided to stay so his children could go to school. He still used his wagon, which he used on the southwest corner of the square where the Standard Oil Station now is. On the wagon was the sign, Sweet Art Car. Mr. DeBose was in business in town at that time also. Paul Biedler recalls having his picture made by Mr. Sweet. He doesn't recall how long Mr. Sweet stayed in town. Then comes G.J. Lobrecht. The next photographer to come to town was G.J. Lobrecht, who came to Mount Pulaski from Decatur, Illinois, in 1901. He got the studio in payment of a debt owed him. He decided that he would like to stay, so in September the family moved into town. Four children were added to the schools, Ruth, Ariel, Dora, and Esther. Dad, Mr. Lobrecht, was 14 years of age when he got his first job in a gallery in Pella, Iowa. He ran errands of all kinds, carried water, coal, ashes, swept out the place. Anything a boy could do, especially carrying water up to that second floor. The gallery was upstairs with no running water, and as photographers needs a lot of water to properly finish a photograph, he had a lot of trips to make up and down those back stairs on finishing days. By this time, 1879, there were changes being made in the methods used. A few tintypes were still being turned out, but paper was becoming the best material, and processing paper needed lots of water. Also, retouching wrinkles and freckles became standard procedure, and if a photographer didn't have good eyesight, he was in trouble. Dad nearly lost his eyesight as a result of all this very close work. He left Iowa for Mississippi, and after a few years, he left there and came to Decatur, Illinois. After a few short years in Decatur, the family moved to Mount Pulaski. Many people remember the studio on the south side of the square where he stayed 16 years. The family's next move was to Carlinville, Illinois, where a very successful studio business was built. Dora returned to Mount Pulaski during the war years, but returned to Carlinville after the war. Dad and Dora decided to move to Texas about 1920. Ariel and Esther, both married, were located in San Antonio. I stayed in Mount Pulaski. Dad's stay in Texas was short, and he returned to Illinois and located in Ottawa, where he had a studio till his death in 36. A granddaughter, Dorothy, has his old studio in Ottawa, and Dora has a studio in Alice, Texas. They are the only ones who follow this work. Gerard and Alfred talk about a duck named Alfonso. I don't recall Alfonso, but Gerard insists that he was an important member of the family. He was also a great strutter and demanded attention. Also, I don't recall where we got the guineas we had at the farm. It has been mentioned Mother got a setting of guinea eggs from Mrs. Franz for her start, and eventually they gave promise of overrunning the farm. They were easy to raise, no trouble, and the best watchdogs ever invented. They roosted in the trees around the house and gave the alarm when anything or anybody strange showed up. They became so numerous we had to thin them out some way, and it was impossible to catch them. So the solution was use a .22 rifle and shoot them. That worked. We always had lots of chickens and, of course, eggs, which we shipped to market in Houston. One time, Dorothy and Alfred became ambitious and went into business raising and selling fryers. For a time, in a small way, they were quite successful. Also, we had banties, particularly banty roosters. I'm not sure where the start came from, but I would guess from the Franz farm. We also had turkeys raised just for family use. I told about one that survived the axe. the strutter that ran away with the wild ones. We did not have pigs or hogs on the farm very often, just didn't fit into our operation. But one time, and I cannot account for it, we did have an old sow with several piglets. Like all little pigs, they did grow up and became as near being pets as pigs ever get to be. They wound up in a large pen with an electric unit to keep them fenced in. You boys tried riding them in this pen and had fun, but not too much success. You also had a small pen out north of the house and were raising rabbits, large white rabbits. They quickly learned to burrow under the fence and go almost anywhere they wanted to, so long as they did not come up out of their burrows. Once in a while, they had to come up for air. Sometimes the mules were out there grazing, and if they stepped on top of one of those rabbit runs, they were choked off from returning home. So they had to come up, and that left them out there in the cold, cruel world. Gradually, we got rid of the rabbits and used the pen for guinea pigs. Worked fine till the snakes found them and dined to their full fill on baby guinea pigs. Sure hard to win every time. We had deer come onto the farm quite often. They would come looking for food when the ranges were in poorer shape, and they would eat up almost any crop quickly. And as we had ranches to the east and south of us, we were quickest to be visited. None of us ever went deer hunting. But one time, Tonner made his mark and brought home the venison without even leaving the farm. Recall the North Slope, that 10-acre piece that was to the northeast corner of the farm proper. That's not counting the lagoon. That particular fall, Tonner had planted it to cowpeas. Had a nice crop, but something was getting it, and they actually saw the deer in there. Pretty near cleaned the field, so Tonner and Johnny Friesian worked up a deal. He, Johnny, had a hot rod special made from a Model A Ford. So one nice moonlit night, they lay for those deer and went headlighting. Yes, that wasn't lawful. The deer, taken by surprise, failed to start running quick enough, and the boys opened up with shotguns loaded with buckshot. They got their deer, and both families ate venison for a time. They took the deer up under the athill east of the mill, where they hung it up and dressed it. I expect that was the only time either of them ever shot at a deer. This item is another taken from my letter to Ariel in 1931. In an earlier tape, you will recall, I told about the traffic cop named Guy Seal who rode a horse at his work. One day, he had parked his horse at the curb by dropping his reins and gone into Joe Seiler's shoe store. To win a bet, Guy called his horse, which was well trained, to come inside the store. And to the utter astonishment of some tourists that witnessed the feat. Well, that story just about matched Arthur Clark's disgust one midnight last winter at the depot in Fremont. Dad, both you and Ariel should remember Arthur. His sister from the east came down to see him this last winter, and she arrived in Fremont about midnight. 'Twas a broad brick nicked. And the train was long, and of course she was in about the last sleeper and was discharged almost way out in the country. Arthur was at the wrong end of the train, of course, and had a long ways to stumble through the dark to reach her. As the conductor was helping her off the train, he anxiously asked her if she had someone to meet her. "I tell you, lady, this is bad country." The idea of anyone saying that about sleepy little Fremont. To be sure, she might have stepped on a rattler, stumbled over a skunk, or even have heard a coyote howl, But still, she would have been a lot safer there than she'd been on any of her city streets. This is an excerpt from one of Alfred's letters written quite a long time ago. It touches on a subject I have been worried about for a long time, repetition. I realize that I am guilty of this, but how to avoid it? The following are his thoughts on the subject. He, of course, is speaking of these tapes. One of the reasons more of this kind of work isn't done in other families rests in the same problem. Information comes to mind in bits and pieces. Much of it's repetition, and some of it is in obvious conflict. To try and edit it is impossible and might mean the deletion of parts most interesting to someone else. I have one of Mom's treasures here with me. It's a Catholic Bible, about 100 years old. A huge tome, about 4 inches thick, between its covers, and in a print, easy to read. The covers are massive, embossed leather, with huge metal clasps. Mom bought this Bible at a secondhand bookstore in Springfield, way back there about the time we left Mount Pulaski. It was so heavy, we had to help her carry it away. About 10 years ago, I sent it to a shop in San Antonio and had it renewed and the cover repaired, so it's still in pretty good repair. It has always held attention from visitors and received very much admiration. Some years ago, about the time Marion was out of school, she came by with another schoolgirl companion, and of course, Marion proudly showed her, the other girl, the Catholic Bible. Both girls, Catholic, of course. She gave it a very close examination, then turned to me and said, "Mr. Lobrecht, I'm awfully sorry I must say this to you. I'm sure it will not make any difference to you, but it might save you embarrassment sometime. This Bible is not a true Catholic Bible." She sure was in a fix, trying to do what was right. A week or so later, I got a letter from her. So apologetic, she had gone to her Monsignor and told him about this Bible, and he quickly assured her she was wrong and our Bible was true. The imprimatur that is used now had not been invented yet when this Bible was printed, and she owed me an apology. We had many dogs during the time we spent on the farm, but I think the most important one was Betty. She was a companion 24 hours a day, especially to you littler ones, for she loved to sleep in bed with them at their feet. Kept their feet so nice and warm. She was very bossy, didn't mind taking command of the situation. Tonner relates how he took her along over to Sanderson's once, and she objected to the big pigs the Sandersons had on the place. She just literally ran them off, and the Sandersons laughed over it. It was so ridiculous. She was boss over all the animals. Once we had a big red bull come and take up residence with our herd of cows. He was what was termed a whipped bull. In his own herd, other bulls had whipped him and run him off, and he had just wandered around cross country till he found a home sweet home in our backyard. You boys would get up the cows and run them into the corral, and always he came along, and you couldn't keep him out. Till Betty came to the rescue. She took him out of there, nothing flat. Being much quicker than the bull, she would bite him on his heels, and the bull would wheel, but Betty would be right there when he came down to bite the other heel. Finally, he'd give up in disgust and leave. After a time, the boys learned to run them all in, including the bull, then give Betty the job of ousting him. She enjoyed it, and even the bull had learned what to do. He would stand patiently outside and wait till the cows were turned out again. Finally, the King Ranch came and retrieved our bull friend. Getting up the mules was also easier with Betty doing the job. Again, she bit their heels. Old Buck was the only one to give trouble. If he was busy nibbling grass and she nipped his heel, Buck would calmly balance on three legs, lift that offending heel. If Betty changed heels, Buck obligingly shifted his position. But eventually, he too would give up and head for the corral. Betty was a great hunter and could kill any of the smaller varmints. And around the feed sheds, she was far ahead of any cat for mice and rats. She was with us a very long time, but one day she went down to the lagoon with Al and Ben and was bitten badly by a snake and died. We had many other dogs, some I have already told you about. Among those were old Toots, of course. Toots was followed by Fluffy, two or three other Spitz dogs. One of them got kicked by a cow and was killed. Another was killed by a snake, and a third stolen. Now, to have one stolen was unusual. Along about the years 26, 7, and 8, we had a very good dog that Alfred named the Wawa. I don't recall his end. Buster, a pup, followed and got into Strickland mother had put out for varmints, and that was his end. Bobby, a little white Spitz pup, was killed by Valentine's truck when they came by for the cream. They felt badly about it and presented you kids with Tarzan to make up for the loss. The last of the farm dogs was Skipper, who had been picked up here in Alice. One day, he was in the car with Mother and I, and for some reason we had stopped at Los Matches. Busy with the car, not watching him, he got out on the highway and was killed. We had many cats, but they were never so important as the dogs. One especially was named Rusty and given to your mother by Mrs. Storm. I mentioned on an earlier tape about the apples grown in central and southern Illinois. Even the smaller communities had their cider mills, just as here in Texas you would find a cotton gin. Each fall, our families would have a barrel of cider pressed out. That was 50 gallons. Some of it was canned for sweet cider in later months. The balance turned to vinegar for kitchen use. As we kids grew older, it fell to our lot to go out and pick the apples, and, of course, my job to take them to the cider mill. This was grown-up stuff. Now, any apple would yield cider, but to those who knew their cider, there was apples and apples, and certainly the season to be considered. The richest, tangiest, tastiest came from the luscious Jonathans, but they should not be picked till after the first light frost had fallen. Wait till the last gasp before freeze, then gather fast. Then you had the nectar of the gods, and it would stay sweet and spicy a long time during the cold weather. On occasion, some orchard man would try to turn we kids loose on another apple, such as the Ben Davis, to pick. But we couldn't be fooled. On one particular year, Mom had been spending all of her time in San Antonio. She had not been too well, and Dad went down there as much of the time as he could, leave me alone there in the studio at the Carlinville. So this particular year, as soon as Christmas work was out of the way, he was busy getting ready for his trip. It was a trip of 23 hours on a crack Katy train out of St. Louis, which is a far cry from today's plane schedules. It was quite the thing to do to carry along a box of goodies for the trip, and Emma was busy fixing up the things for him. We had all been enjoying the cider so much, Emma suggested she put in a bottle of cider into his lunchbox. Seemed like a good idea, so they put in two bottles. Nowadays, if you reach for an empty bottle, likely it will be a Coke bottle, but not so in those days. These were the days of prohibition. Cokes were practically unknown, but an awful lot of corn liquor was distributed around in the familiar flat pint bottles. These bottles were everywhere, and what could be more natural than their use? And surprising enough, their appearance was deceiving when filled with the tasty amber nectar. I wish you could have heard Dad spin this tale. His trip started out uneventful and quickly settled into tedium by mid-morning of the next day. Some guy sitting next to Dad, bored, stretched, yawned, complained loudly how dry he was. What wouldn't he give for just one quick snort? Dad, ever one for a little practical joke, leaned over and in an undertone asked him, "Friend, would you like a little of Christmas cheer?" He came to life with a jerk. Yes, but where and how could they accomplish it? Drinking on a train was more than frowned on. Broad daylight and a very busy train, they were in the smoker. Smokers are the first car making up the train, and the first seat of the smoker was traditionally reserved for the conductor. It was his office. So this guy figured it all out. Wait till the conductor walks into the next car. Then grab his seat. Now they are at the head of the train. No one can walk in on them from the front. Slide down on your backbone and heist a quickie. Then raise up nonchalantly. Go about your business. No one the wiser. Well, it worked perfect. Up to the second gulp. Then he came to spluttering. What the hell? And quickly added, but it was damn good. Then an unholy gleam came into his eye. He knew another man down in the next car, a perfect sucker. Again the stunt worked. And after each sucker fell for the bait, came the hunt for another thirsty victim. Had a hilarious time. First bottle went quickly, and the second didn't last long either. Dad said he never enjoyed cider more and didn't even get to taste it. Little did he, not quite acceptable in polite society when it came out, made considerable uproar. I sat by the Duchess of Tea, and a very great lady was she, but the rumblings abdominal were simply phenomenal, and they all laughed because they thought it was me. See a penny and pick it up all day long, you'll have good luck. Now that's been one with us a long time. Alicia claims she and Pete found coins frequently while walking. True, mostly pennies and other small coins. They put all these coins in a pot and saved over several years and accumulated about $100. I wish I had done that. Every day I walk 5 blocks to buy my morning paper. Frequently I find a coin or two. Quarters are the largest denomination. Today I found only a penny. Last week, I found a lady's handbag open and the contents strewn all over the end of the lane and the back lots. Everything in that mess that a lady could have had in a handbag, except money, only 20 cents. Paid bills, some unpaid, credit cards, letters, just name it, it was there. Gerard called the police and turned it over to the mess to them. A few days later, I met the lady victim at the site, hunting for some keys. She explained to me what had happened. That night, she and her husband came home late, entered the kitchen door, and went right to bed. She left her bag on the kitchen table in plain sight, and the kitchen light burning. The kitchen door had a latch that you turn and close the door, and it locked. This latch was faulty, and unless the door was carefully closed, it failed to lock. The thief came up on the porch and, looking through the glass at the door, saw the bag sitting there, unattended, tried the door, and it was open. So he stepped in, picked up the bag, carefully closed the door, and was gone. The moral of the story is, check and then double check, very carefully. An article in recent Reader's Digest was discussing the differences between graffiti and the modern bumper sticker craze. Graffiti expressed the writer's opinion in utter anonymity, but the bumper sticker announces to the world who sponsors its message. I've been a bumper sticker observer for some time, but yesterday I saw one that topped them all. It was shouting for an Alice Fern. It read, "The Lario Club, we manufacture and service hangovers." Selah. As you all know, Connor and I go often to spend the evening with the different Golden Old clubs in Carpenter. The evening is spent dancing and just goofing around with the friendly folk. At these visits, the subject often comes up. What do you do to spend the time? The commonest answer is bowling, followed by almost anything else you could think of. No one ever heard of this offbeat pop or blue pop on the moon. Never heard of such a thing. They wouldn't try. Okay, though, another member of the family would go for it. One younger lady there was much interested, though, and asked me a lot of questions. She dreamed of interesting her parents in the project. One night, she stumped me. When was I going to let her read my book? Funny World. Some people write easily, but to me, it's a task. A squib in which the easy digest refused squib. To them, it's simple. Writing is easy. All you have to do is get paper and pencil and be seated at the desk. Then chronicle what has occurred to you. The only drawback was in making it occur. Well, we had one big occurrence that I haven't told you about, but most of you were there and enjoyed it even as much as I did. Of course, I refer to the family reunion, May 24, 1980. Bob Doherty's in Fort Worth and almost the whole family there. Doherty and Joanne were the perfect host, and their home was ideal for the meeting. I enjoyed every hour and the privilege of visiting with each of you. What I did miss was the opportunity of spending time with each little one as an individual, and we were becoming acquainted on their terms. I enjoyed them so much. They were the biggest attraction. As a group, they quickly accepted each other and played together in a happy, noisy party. They were wonderful. The unusual had to happen. For the moment, that huge living room was almost deserted as I passed through. And just then, Nancy's little blondie Elizabeth came through very unhappy. Something had gone wrong, so I picked her up and covered her in a large chair, and quickly all was fair weather again. Besides, her tears were falling. Their noise of play was urgent, and she struggled to get down. I held her very closely and asked her earnestly, "Surely you could stay here just 2 minutes?" She returned the look just as earnestly and soberly answered, "No. Only 6 hours." And with that, she slid to the floor and was gone. The panels were busy, and from the results I had seen, turned out nicely. I get much pleasure from the large group made in front of the fireplace in the living room. I thank all of you for being so patient in its assembly. I look at it long and smile with a tear. I really would have enjoyed the whole day. Well, Hurricane Allen has come by and left. According to reports, the second most devastating hurricane to visit Texas during the past century. Connor was here with me, and he battened-bound the hatches and prepared for the worst. Namely, boarded up the 2 barred windows and taped all smaller ones. Then he gathered up all these things around the yard, such as garbage cans, and anything the wind could pick up and blow around. We hid these in the middle of the bamboo grove, and it was like putting them in a cave. Then he opened the vent into the attic in the hallway and the hot water closet, then opened the front door and the back kitchen door, and we were ready, and all went well. The eye of the storm did not pass over us, so we did not have that change of direction of the wind. The storm was always from the east, so we kept the doors open, watched the trees fall. We looked as if a bulldozer had run through our yard after it was all over. The largest part of that big eucalyptus tree broke off and fell on the north edge of the Morris's bedroom, cushioned in the fall by that large pine tree and a smaller tree. It did small damage to the house, but did it gum up our driveway. Took about 3 days before we could get a car out of the yard. and there's still a big log in there that we can't move. Luckily, Tommy had parked his car in a clear spot in the vacant back lot. We lost several trees as well as much damage to others, so many trees were simply denuded of all leaves. That large mesquite at the corner of Jim's yard on our back lot had a big limb so little Gerard couldn't walk under it. It was taken out by the roots and stood up on edge with that limb Gerard couldn't walk under, standing high in the air, tangled up in the high power electric line. The last time I reported it was a crew came to pull about 40 feet from that tree to make a minor repair. I called their attention to the mess, and they agreed that needed immediate attention, but it wasn't their job. So that tree is still there, and we stay out from under it. Connor had a chainsaw with him, and we stayed busy quite a spell. Got small logs all over the place, but the mess is largely cleaned up. We have been blessed with soft, slow, soft showers that soaked in, and nearly all denuded trees are out in new leaves. Only the Chinese lacquer has failed to make a comeback. This is the year of the bug or the worm. Since the storm, we have literally been eaten up by bugs and worms. Gerard had such a nice fall garden started, sweet corn almost knee-high, among other items, all went overnight. There seems to be several types of looper worms. One took our Bermuda grass in the backyard overnight. A different type is working on the fall grass in our neighbor's backyard, and all kinds of non-loopers take what's left. You all know the bright green worm about as large as a finger, has yellow horns, likes tomatoes and so forth. Gerard pulled a new one on us yesterday. He picked up a big worm like those horned giants, only his find was much larger and jet black and horns much smaller. We only found one of those. The first thing the worms scrabbled were the peppers, included the chili peppers and the little ornamental red peppers. Stripped the plants bare down to the twigs. By now, the bugs and the worms have largely left us and things are getting back to normal. The peppers, the worst hurt, are slow in getting leaf growth back. We have had a miserable summer, hot, very dry. By dint of much watering, we had a pretty fair garden and quite a lot of vegetables. We still have more okras than we can use up, and that's about all right now, October 6th. However, Gerard has a nice garden started for this fall, and the weather is a bit cooler, and we should have vegetable seed in a few weeks. You can easily become spoiled. I think this past summer was the most miserable season I have spent in Texas. No rain since small showers last spring. Water shortages everywhere. Our lake, the reservoir, just about dried up. The lake got down to 4 million gallons, and the waterworks was pumping 5 and 6 million gallons a day. The trouble was, the city was using 6 million gallons or more each day, so they put the whole town on a ration basis. There would be no more car washing at any time, any place. Then they had divided the city into four zones. They were the southeast segment and were allowed to water lawns and gardens during the hours of 12:01 a.m. to 8 a.m. and again during the hours between 5 p.m. and 12 p.m. and these only on Tuesdays of each week. Then they carefully reduced the water pressure till it was a small trickle out of the end of the hose and turned it loose. It didn't work. Rightly, the restrictions were largely disregarded. Anyway, the lake was rapidly going dry, and then came the Hurricane Allen and plenty of showers, and our water problems have all been forgotten. There was always plenty of water in the lake at Mathis, but our system was too small to pump the amount the city needed, so our reservoir was never filled. Also, they don't have the pumps to distribute that much water to our mains. So for the present, we sit tight again. Ariel's daughter, Dee, and her son, Mark, came to visit us this past May 1980. Mark is confined to a hospital at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, has trouble with injury to his right leg, and is worried by possibility of amputation. he can get around with crutches a little, and they let him out long enough to come down here for a little visit. Have heard from him a couple of times since, and he seems a bit more cheerful. We enjoyed their visit very much, even though it was a show. They report Ariel has been quite ill. Also had a visit from Bill Owen, dropped in quite unexpectedly, and to my surprise, he was driving a pickup. He had sold his plane. We had a nice visit talking about life in Fremont and down on the farm. He asked for pictures with him in them from the farm. He had nothing. I handed him the family album from that era, and he sure enjoyed looking at it. He picked out three and asked for copies. Gerard mailed them today. One of them I always enjoyed. Gerard, Connor, Bill, and another unnamed kid with a dog bill, all playing on the upended bales of cotton stored in the yard at the Fremont Inn. Another he picked was a football group of Fremont High School, and he was in it. The third, I'm not sure he was in. The picture was the new tall diving platform you boys had made and installed in the tank. If I recall correctly, there were seven people in midair diving off of that platform. Looks like a bunch of bullfrogs jumping off a log in a creek. We cannot name the people. Connor started something different this fall. He gathered a lot of ebony seed. This has been a good year for the ebony. I drilled them for him, and he strung himself a new necklace. Looks right nice. The soft brown, mostly the seed is flat, and much smaller than the laurel seed. So I tried a second string and gave them to Evelyn. It is remarkable how they blend with the different materials. I wonder if their soft brown will change to a shiny brown surface with age. This is another of Ariel's letters. I had written to her in 1931. Snakes have been numerous since the weather turned hot, and old Toots, the sick dog, killed a rattler up under the hazel trees near the house. More people have been reported bitten this summer than any other since we've been here. Last week, two in Tiberias. One, a man, died, but the other, a child, recovered. A freak snake story also came out. I don't vouch for its authenticity. A man named Albert Bennett from here in Alice manages a big farm of some 1,200 acres southeast of here, and he was the victim. I was out to his place last spring doing some work, and his father, who was showing me around, insisted it was the worst rattler-infested spot in Texas. One day last week, they rushed Albert into the doctor. He had let a rattler squirt venom into one of his eyes. Now, all snake authorities agree, with Colonel Crimmins in particular, that snake venom does no harm unless injected into the bloodstream. This is an aside to me. You may not know, some of you, who Colonel Crimmins was, but he was a writer in the San Antonio papers back during that era, and he wrote very much about all of South Texas on snakes and the varmints in particular. He was an authority. That snake venom does no harm unless injected into the bloodstream. Some go so far as to insist that you could swallow the venom, and it would do no other than to act as a powerful digestive stimulant. Maybe so, but I don't want to swallow any of it or have any of it squirted in my eyes. Albert had killed an unusually large rattler. He had no time to be choosy, so he used the only weapon at hand, a stick that wasn't very large. He thought he had done a thorough job of killing the snake and had stooped over it to examine it. Just as he stooped over, the snake came to life and struck. Albert fended off the strike with his stick, which he still held in his hand, in front of him. In striking, the snake hit the stick with but one fang. The venom from the other fang squirted into his eye. They said he looked terrible, and his eye all inflamed, and he insisted his whole neck was stiff at the time. I saw him not long after, and it looked like as though he had suffered no lasting effect. For those of you who know little about rattlers, his fangs are like hollow needles. There are two in number at the front of the upper jaw, except from striking, these fangs are sheathed and not visible. When excited, the snake sticks these fangs out much as a cat bears his claws. The force of the strike pumps the venom into the wound. The length of fangs vary as the size of snake. Would be a very large snake with fangs 1/2 inch long. When a mother muscovite duck stole out a nest, so she let her set, but slipped under her wings a couple of extra eggs. She hatched off and now has several little muscovies and one each right peeking and runner. The old mother duck immediately took them to the lagoon and reverted to the wild. Didn't see them for days at a time, but lately Gerard has found them and has been trying to feed them. Mother also set a hen on turkey eggs, and the old hen hatched them out and raised 7 little turkeys. We have a little motherless white duckling. That poor baby duck sure wanted another mother badly. Tried her best to join those baby turkeys, but the old hen objected and drove it off. It was funny to watch that duck. It would wait until the mother hen would cover its baby turkeys and would then sneak in behind and crowd in under the old hen. Gradually it forced its way until at last the old hen gave up and let it join. Today the turks are about as large as the old hen, and she has left them long ago and started laying again. But all 7 of the turks and the baby duck still trail her all day long. Apparently that duck doesn't realize he isn't a turkey. Ah, ye of little faith. This is a letter I wrote to Mom. The sky is brassy, heat hangs like a blanket over the land. The grass is dry and parched, water holes are no more. Strange birds and animals rarely approach our tank in search of water. Day after day this goes on, and the old story of the frogs that have never seen water comes to mind. Whole flocks of chicks have reached maturity without ever experiencing a rainstorm. Pigs and calves have known only the moisture of a gentle dew. We look hopefully into the sky, and all we see are heat waves that scorch the eyes like a blast. The wind is hot by day, and you shiver at night. The little dust devils dance all over the land. You can appreciate the lament of the now popular song, Dust. Woe is our lot, for we lack the faith. More than 6 months this has been going on, and suddenly, with no warning, a gentle rumbling is heard in the distant sky. The pigs, terrified, scamper to their pens. The calves huddle up against their mothers in apprehension. I, without thinking, look heavenward and exclaim, we are safe. Old Fernando is speaking to God again. Emma wanted to know what I meant, and I told her the following story. It has taken just these conditions to bring back the simple tale told me many years ago by Frank McGill, one of 3 brothers who owned the Santa Rosa Ranch. This ranch lies some 40 miles to the southeast of us, along the coast, and is one of the oldest settlements in South Texas. Dating back to the earliest recollections of man in these parts, it has always been a cattle ranch off of the beaten path, secluded, busy, and its people, knowing no other life, have lived, worked, and loved the life on the ranch for generations. True, there have been transient owners of the ranch, but always the land has all really belonged to the simple people who have followed in their father's footsteps have loved the ranch with a devotion that only can be centered on a home. This story goes back many years, but Frank assures me the ranch today is still the same as it was then, the same faithful people loving and working the land, and with him the only change as the current transient owner. It was a dry, hot summer, much like this year of 1943, probably much worse. The winter days dry and dusty, spring fulfilling no hope, and each summer day following with added heat. The sandy dunes and coastal plains of the Santa Rosa were as barren as the beaches that reached to the bay. When it is lush, the Santa Rosa is a beautiful country. As far as the eye can see in any direction, easy rolling plains with no trees or bushes in sight. In proper seasons, the lands will be vast gardens of wildflowers of brilliant hues. God was good to me. My one visit to the Santa Rosa was a lovely spring day, and it was a breathless sight. Turn from the plains, and you enter another domain of deep sand, the open spots, drifting dunes, hemmed in by great forests of live oak trees. But this year there was no beauty, only the stark reality of a burning sun that devoured even life itself. In these earlier days, man had not yet discovered our underlying fresh water and the possibilities of water wells. All water had to be caught and stored when it rained. The cattle had to rely entirely on the lakes and small streams. As the summer wore on, the water holes dried up, and the poor cows died by the hundreds for want of water. Even the people's supplies, so carefully guarded, dwindled till rationing was resorted to. The oldest and most revered of the Santa Rosa people was old Fernando. Born on the ranch, had never been away from it. His life had been dedicated to the ranch and his charges, the cows. While old Fernando's years stretched back further than the remembrance of any of the other ranch people, also his charro days, till even he could not remember when he had not been beside a horse. Riding out to care for his beloved cows. Even greater than old Fernando's love of the ranch was his devotion to his maker and love of his fellow man. He was truly a good man, and in return was loved and revered by his people. In his latter years, he was stooped and gray, but still clear-eyed and a leader among his people. He had been relieved from his charro duties, but had taken unto himself many of the smaller jobs and chores around the land. Age settled on him like a mantle during this year of the great drought, and as the burning days succeeded each other, old Fernando seemed to grow weaker and sadder over the hopeless situation. At night he would walk out under the stars among the cows that lay too weak to even beg for water. To see so many of them suffer and die filled his soul with great sorrow. And one morning, when Benito went to call him, they found him in his long last sleep. The Santa Rosa was very sad, and they went about the burial with loving care. The padre was too far away, so Benito must now take charge and say the few simple words of the service. Benito was his friend, and also a very devout man, so it was right and proper that he should do so. They gathered around the new grave in the age-old burial plot, and Benito spoke to his people. Friends, we have come here to bury Fernando, but we should not be sad. Most of you are sorry for him and think he died because he was old and could no longer stand the burning sun and lack of rain. But you are wrong. Fernando died because he could not bear to see his beloved cows die from the heat and lack of food and water. Fernando knew that God is good, but also very busy. And also the Santa Rosa is a very small place in this big world. God has just forgotten the Santa Rosa. Fernando died so he could go see God and ask him to send rain and save the Santa Rosa. And God will see Fernando and listen to his plea, for Fernando is a very good man. So now, friends, we must all go home and prepare for the good rains that will come very quickly. And the people all believed Benito, for he, being a devout man, knew of such things. So they finished their prayers, arranged the grave, and hurried home to prepare for the rains that were sure to come. And within the hour, the first gentle rumbling sounded in the distant sky, and not a cloud in sight. But Benito was very sure. He obeyed. Reverently, he murmured, "We are saved." Old Fernando was speaking to God. Soon followed gentle sprinkles, and before nightfall came the rain. Great forests, the lagoons filled, the streams flowed rushing rivers, and the riders had to keep to the high spots so they wouldn't bog down in the prairie. For 3 days it rained, and soon the grass was growing and flowers bloomed again. The cows had grass to eat and water to drink, and the days were good, and the Santa Rosa once more. Benito called his people together, and they all gave thanks and said prayers for old Fernando, who had done so much for them. And even today, the people on the Santa Rosa remember and know they are safe. For while God may be too busy before it is too late, he will see old Fernando again and listen to his pleas for the Santa Rosa. So today, when these simple people hear the first rumblings of thunder, they reverently bow, cross themselves, and murmur, "Fernando is speaking to God again. It will rain again, maybe tomorrow, maybe next day, but it will rain again before it's too late." Even I get comfort from the tale. Certainly it can't rain. Nothing points to it. Our farm is so dreary, it has never been so dry. The orange trees shrivel, and the fruits are dead. We try and water the main trees, and out of a clear sky comes a gentle rumble. Truly, old Fernando is speaking to God again. It will rain once more and soon. How could I have lacked the faith? Much love, world. I don't think I ever told you about my first real paid job. I was a kid. I had a... The first job I ever had was a kid. I don't know my age, but I worked about 10 years. Across the hall from Bob's studio was a lawyer's office, and the chairs and hall were his responsibilities. So I was hired and required to sweep them every weekday for the princely sum of 50 cents a month. And at times, collecting from him presented problems. I will never forget my first payday. A whole 50 cents in one big shiny silver coin. What would I do with it? I don't know whose idea it was, but Dad took me down to George Rook's, the cashier at the bank, and introduced me to him with the request I'd be allowed to open an account. I've often wondered if those two didn't have that all picked up ahead of me, ahead of time. An account was opened for me, and I left there with my little bank book like any other adult. Imagine me at that age with a checking account of 50 cents. But I don't recall ever missing depositing that monthly 50 cents. And as time went by, I found other money to also deposit, and I was very proud of my bank book.